Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Please welcome John Kalisky. Thank you.
Thanks, Louise, and thank you, Tom, for the wonderful exhibit, and Gloria for working with Tom, and Will for helping to organize this. I understand I'm going to be moderating this tonight. No one told me that till I walked in, but so now I'm like having a kerfluffle in my brain. But and also, I wanted to make these introductions, and there were five things that I wanted to mention. Actually, there were four, but fifth one showed up. Actually, I love Stephen's computer because somebody in his office wrote, "Escape, mouse and click, Allowed Library." You know, I hope you know how to use your computer better than that. But it will be a challenge, possibly. Anyway, there were five things I wanted to talk about in terms of the introduction to this particular event. One was that how many of you have gone to all the two previous lectures at this? Well, fantastic. That's good. Because, as you know, I wasn't unfortunately at the first one, but I understood it was an incredible performance by Tom Hines talking about Neutra and the show and things like that. And gave a great introduction and framed many of the discussions that have occurred. The second was the conversation with Christopher Hawthorne and Michael Maltzen about architecture and urbanism, and Michael seemed to make what I thought was the curious point that architects of his generation, which Michael's still laboring under the illusion that there's not another whole generation even younger than him who's already like ready to kill him, but Michael basically made this claim that, you know, his generation was not confrontational, and that in some way that set architecture up for possibly a more conciliatory role as a medium for the resolution of urban issues. And that was a very, very, I thought, interesting point, and perhaps we'll get back to that because that's a way that design matters. And then there was one that sort of flew into my mind as I was going through today, having to do with design mattering, and that was, I don't know how many of you know this, but someone who was actually the only decent architecture instructor I ever had, Charles Guathmey, died today. And he had been sick for a while, but nevertheless, someone from my office came in and, you know, said, "John, Charlie Guathmey died," and I felt really bad about that for a while. And I was thinking, like, what was it about Charlie that was so fantastic? Because he was, you know, it was a very interesting studio. He gave us a library project, and we're in a library, and, you know, I didn't know what I was doing, but I would just do things. And one day, well, I can't really tell that story because it's too crude. But the thing about it is that Charlie was an amazing individual because he had a remarkable lifelong passion where all he wanted to do was really, well, he had several things he wanted to do, but the only thing he did with me was talk about architecture for the most part. And he did it in an incredibly knowing and convincing way. And I always think that a lot of the time in these conversations, you know, as we seek as architects to expand our reach, to move beyond our own limited professional focus and somehow connect ourselves to the world at large, and as also architecture as a profession becomes highly, highly specialized with, you know, experts on codes and experts on egress and experts on materials and experts on sustainability and, you know, new urbanists who think they ought to license themselves. I don't know what they're licensing themselves for. And, you know, we have this highly specialized world that we start losing sight of the fact that there are some people who are out there who just, you know, do architecture because they can't help themselves. They can't do anything else. And they become incredibly passionate about it, and they become, it becomes a sort of lifelong way of living and breathing and seeing the world. And Charlie was one of those people, and he certainly inspired me to, and he taught me things about architecture in terms of its deep structure that I've never really, really forgotten. And what's always remarkable to me is that whenever you see a drawing, like the drawings in the Neutra show, or you talk to people like Stephen or Leo, you have these sort of moments of spark inside of you where you realize that amongst a somewhat small group of people, that there's this desire to talk about the built environment in a particular way that we all really, really love, and it's probably untranslatable in the end. It's very difficult to describe to people who aren't architects or to spend 2 or 3 hours talking about, you know, how you diagram ramps in, say, Le Corbusier buildings and talk about things like, moving up ramps and compression and satanic rituals and things like that. And then saying it's all based upon an A-B-A-B grid and it's all then based upon certain dimensional performance standards, and it all becomes a very peculiar language. And so when we have a conversation about design matters, sometimes I think that we forget about this sort of core beauty to the art or the craft, if you will. But I felt I had to say something about Charlie because he just was someone who was very meaningful to me when I was a young architect. And over the years, when I saw him, he would remember every single conversation we ever had when we were in the studio together. So hopefully design matters in some way because it's about something, architecture, that certain people feel incredibly passionate about, and they pursue with a type of discipline, and a word that Charlie used, rigor, that allows them to make discoveries that then somehow serve a larger audience. And certainly when you look at the Neutra drawings upstairs, there's no doubt at all that you see that type of commitment and that type of lifelong passion and that type of spirit in those drawings. And when you look at the body of work that Leo Marmel and Stephen Ehrlich have produced over, in one case, 25 years or so, and in the other case, 35 years, right? Something like that, 35 years. You see that as well. And so let me introduce the two of them, and then what we're going to do is have Stephen talk first for about 10 minutes, and then Leo talk, and I'll introduce them in reverse order and just say a couple of things about them. Leo Marmel, as I'm sure many of you know, is one of the partners or principals in Marmel, Radziner & Associates, which over time has, I think, become a giant enterprise of incredible entrepreneurial ambition. And I think that, you know, Leo and Ron represent a type of architect that's, say, 5-10 years younger than I am, who they were educated at a certain moment in time where they began to anticipate in some way architecture as young people practice it now, but they're still bridges. And what I mean by that is if you talk to a typical architecture kid getting out of school right now, because they're totally immersed in this digital world and you can do spreadsheets and you can do computer modeling and you can do, massive information searches all sitting at your little workstation, you think you can do absolutely everything. And what's curious to me is there was a type of kind of more manual type of person who prefigured that. And I always think of Leo and Ron as being those people because from the beginning they connected construction with design. From the beginning they connected modernism with historic preservation. From the beginning they connected a type of entrepreneurial spirit. And they've gone on to found several ventures, which I'm sure we'll hear about, one of which has to do with prefab, which, by the way, Neutra was interested in his entire life, and the other one, furniture. So they are masters of all trades, in essence, and they have a type of capacity to work from spoons to cities, which is incredibly unusual for architects, but is also a hallmark, I think, in some ways of architectural ambition. Leo himself graduated from Cal Poly Pomona, so I guess he must have grown up here, right?
San Luis Obispo.
San Luis Obispo, excuse me, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, a hideous mistake on my part, particularly for those of you who went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. But you must have grown up here in California, though I have no idea well. So you are a native, and bring that to him. And as I said, he's, you know, involved in all aspects of the work in his office, and it will be really wonderful to hear what he has to say. Stephen Ehrlich, who I'll introduce now so we don't have to have a bunch of jumpiness. He has a really interesting background. I've heard him talk about many of these things in the past. I think that he's representative as well of a certain moment in time, and that the first thing that he did really after he got out of school was he spent some time in the Peace Corps, and he was in, I believe, Morocco. Is that correct? And I've seen you present and talk about how much sort of that experience sort of has shaped so much of your work. And it's interesting, I was in Stephen's office maybe a year or two ago, probably a little over a year ago, and there was this project in Dubai that you were working on, which was a fairly amazing house. But what was really remarkable about it was the level in which there was a type of wider search for how one integrated sort of local traditions, at least in a general way, I would say, with highly, highly ambitious contemporary architecture. And I've always admired that about Stephen's work. I've had the privilege of having to review his work in the city of Santa Ana, and it was really interesting because it was in some ways, on paper, perhaps the most banal project one could think of. It was a strip mall. But it was a contemporary strip mall, and Stephen brought to it a type of logic that I think is very, very optimistic and hopeful for the future. And the developer was wise enough to bring Stephen into the process. Stephen was working alongside architects who are experts at production architecture in terms of production housing and production strip malls. And he was given the assignment of sort of creating the zipper that would tie the commercial side and the pure residential side together with these live-work units, and created this really fantastic crescent of housing. And I remember thinking at the time that, well, you know, he's a very ambitious architect. I don't think this could possibly work here in Orange County on the most crazy of streets opposite a shopping mall. But it sure is wonderful that he's trying. And then I was back there, not that long ago, and it was amazing to me that it was doing exactly everything that he had hoped that it would do. It was occupied, people had businesses in it. They were a weird mix between purely domestic and some commercial, and it was serving as this wonderful scene between this kind of more automobile-oriented strip world, if you will, and this kind of more production housing Orange County world behind it. I think recently, I haven't seen it, but I followed with great interest his design-build exercise out in Phoenix, which is another type of design-build exercise that hopefully he'll talk about, where he was the architect for the Walter Cronkite Center. And so with that, I will introduce Stephen and look forward to what you have to say.
Hi, pleasure to be here. And I'm going to try to be very rapid, 10 minutes. Why does design matter? Well, I'm going to talk about community, density, culture, and sustainability. This is Marrakesh, Morocco. If the lights can lower a little bit, that would be great. Thank you. This is a throbbing center for the entire south of Morocco, and you can just tell from this photo that the making of place and the gathering of people is, in fact, a very important act and a wonderful place to be. And I think I learned very important lessons from this, from living there for a couple of years. This happens to be the Westwood Library, one of the city's branch libraries. It's an interesting project in that it's the first branch library in Los Angeles that has underground parking, and kind of a harbinger, I think, of issues to come where land is so valuable that, in fact, the car now has to be below the building. But we were trying to make place and trying to create places of gathering. We saw the building as an opportunity to create a front porch on this street in Westwood. And here you see where people are gathering, kids wait, they can sit on steps, they can hang out at the balcony, and proceed up the stairway to the second level, which is the main reading room. And an interesting story about this is that you can see that wonderful the series of trees outside the window looking towards the northeast. And it's actually looking at, we borrowed that space. It's a small cemetery where Marilyn Monroe is buried in Westwood. Another project that we were trying to reinforce the making of community, you see the orange square around a building we did. This is Cambridge, Massachusetts. MIT is on the right, the Longfellow Bridge connecting to Boston. And this was a biotech research building in Cambridge where there are six stories of essentially very highly secretive genetic research going on. However, we felt it was really important that at the street level and at the park, the building would engage with the community. So three of the corners have retail establishments that open out onto the park and onto the street. In a sense, creating community and interest in that social responsibility. Inside the building is this large vessel where we bring light into the center of the building. And what we tried to do here was create what I like to call living rooms in the sky. And the living rooms in the sky are basically large ledges, if you will, that float into this atrium. And what happens, we're finding that as the scientists go deeper and deeper into their experiments, they become fairly isolated into their experiments, into their computer research. And yet it's by the coffee bar and it's by having these chance encounters occur, not unlike the chance encounters that always occurred in the Place Jemel Fna in Marrakesh, Morocco. So in a sense, it's making community within the community of the research science going on in this building. And another project that dealt with trying to reinforce community is the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. As you know, Walter recently passed away at 92. And this is for ASU, Arizona State University. At ground level are also retail establishments. Again, the idea that the building isn't only about what happens inside, it's also about its responsibility to the street and to the neighborhood and to the community. Phoenix just put in the light rail. You see the light rail coming up Central Avenue. And there's this large three-story front porch, if you will, that gathers people, and it's along a pedestrian mall. So again, there's an engagement of the inside spaces at ground level with the street. The building is very much about expressing what it does inside. You can see the satellite dishes. We actually were able to get 28 variances in one day with the city of Phoenix. I've never had that happen in LA yet, I might add. This project was phenomenal for us in that it embraced what's called the design-build delivery method, where contractor and architect worked as a team. This project was also for the city of Phoenix and for Arizona State University. And we started design, and 20 months later, the building was occupied. I've never seen anything happen that fast. And mind you, 235,000 square feet. Inside the building is the forum, a principal gathering place where, again, that idea that the chance encounter can happen. And I think this reinforces the sense of community within the building. Density. On the right hand, you see a photo of Marrakesh, Morocco. And these are courtyards. In fact, it's quite amazing that Marrakesh actually rivals the density of Manhattan. On the left, you see the American dream turned into a nightmare, where that vision that we always have to hold on to that house plop down into the middle of our yard. However, as land values go up, density increases, and that paradigm just doesn't work anymore. So this interest in courtyards and density has really been something that I wanted to explore. I thought it would be interesting to show this project for several reasons. One is because of the Neutra exhibit. The photo in the upper left-hand corner is a 1938 The Lewin Residence by Richard Neutra. And let's see if I can point to this. Yeah, there we go. And there is the original Neutra house. My clients bought the adjacent lot, and we created a kind of an extension to the house, and the project actually, I think, has is maybe this will come up in the Q&A, but it's kind of an interesting debate of whether one should even touch the, you know, the work of a master. But the reality is that I believe the clients have helped preserve the original house by protecting the land next to it. It didn't get into the hands of others who would have surely built a McMansion there. And in a sense, this is a very referential space that looks back and honors the house that we lovingly restored on the inside of the original. And embraced certain ideas, including a sliding door that can extend the courtyard, the inside space, to the outside and off into the Pacific Century. Another example of increased density, and these projects are really about urban infill. I think urban infill is very important because it also bespeaks about a certain sustainable strategy where people are not driving further and further out into greater distances, but in fact are saying, let's rediscover the communities that exist, the existing neighborhoods, reinforce them. And I think people in Los Angeles are really hungry for that experience, and that's why you have so many wonderful kind of emerging cities like Culver City, Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, beyond emerging. I mean, they're just getting always better. And here, but embracing the notion that you can expand indoor and outdoor space with a rolling glass garage door. Culture. This is in southern Nigeria, and I became fascinated with this building. I was just driving by, of course not my own, but fascinated that this man, the owner, loved his house so much that he dressed like his house. And it somehow the exuberance is pure Nigerian, and I felt that, and I do feel that, in fact, a project should be very responsive of a climate. How does it respond? Of a culture. This is a rather large house in the Arabian Desert in Dubai, and the roof is the size of a football field in the shape of a crescent moon, and the crescent moon has strong symbolism in Islam, meaning new life, new beginning. The roof is lifted up and creates essentially the shade, not unlike a Bedouin tent. We also dug deep water wells and were able to take water from the earth, deep inside the earth, bring it and create an oasis where we also, with the large shaded structure, create sunscreens, which are basically interpretations of a musharabia or an arabesque, contemporized arabesque sunscreen. And I am fascinated by that John Kaliski alluded to. I am fascinated by the concept of how can you be local and global simultaneously. And I think a house in Dubai should not look like a house in Detroit. So I think these are interesting questions, and I think that it does even challenge some of the notions that are inherent in international modernism and even perhaps in prefab. Maybe Leo will discuss that. And then lastly, sustainability. Along the shores of Lake Tanganyika in Tanzania, they completely skipped the Industrial Revolution and went directly into the 21st century. After I was in the Peace Corps, I did teach for 3 years at Amadou Bello University in Nigeria and was able to actually build an experimental theater built out of mud. And this will be, I know, the most sustainable building I will ever get to build, because when they stop maintaining it, it will just melt back to the earth from which it came. But in fact, it's still alive. It's been there since the mid-70s. And it's still a beloved structure that embraces all forms of dance and performance. And lastly, this is my family's house. It's an infill lot. It talks a lot about the issues, many of the issues that I've talked about, reinforcing community, infill lot within walking distance of wonderful streets, including Abbot Kinney and the beach. I've integrated all natural weathering materials. There's no air conditioning. All the All the sun is controlled by shades that can go up and down, and that allows the amount of penetration of heat into the house to be controlled. And doors can open wide, natural ventilation, radiant heat in the floor, photovoltaics on the roof, and the idea that sustainability is not only added active items like photovoltaic cells, but it's really important to go back to the fundamentals of understanding basically the knowledge that was and the wisdom that has always existed in the architecture without architects or the vernacular architecture throughout the world. Thank you.
So I should begin by confessing, my first confession for the evening is that I wrote these words on Stephen's computer. Escape, move, double click. I am transitioning from Stephen's presentation to mine, F5. And I look up, and there it is. So, okay, everything's going wonderfully. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction earlier, and I'm really thrilled to be here with Stephen, who I've known for many, many years. This is our office in West Los Angeles, and this was our office many, many years ago, 20 years ago, I believe, when we were in this space. We had this small storefront, and for many years we were most known not for our work, of course, but for our marquee sign. We had this storefront, we didn't know what to do with that leftover sign, so every week we put up a different quote and began communicating with our neighbors. And it was a wonderful opportunity to get their feedback for the quotes that we put up, and we learned a great deal about our neighborhood. I was going to speak this evening a little bit about our restoration work with Mr. Neutra, and then Thomas Hines came, and then Dia Neutra came, so I'm not going to say a word about Mr. Neutra. But I will talk a little bit about the process of restoration and why we believe this is so important to us on so many levels. And in thinking about why design matters, what I thought I'd do this evening is just present some thoughts, some challenges, so that we can discuss them together, Stephen and John and I, and then I hope with all of you. I think preservation is that wonderful arena in which the architect is thrust into the cultural dialogue, the place in which we are challenged for every single thing we do because we care so much about the objects that we're messing with, that we are somehow altering. I think that is a wonderful arena for conversation. Unfortunately, I think the conversation about preservation often becomes personal and negative and critical, and we forget the importance of why we're having that conversation. This is a conversation about what's important to us, where we've come from, what is it that matters to us as a community, and what should be preserved. Should everything be preserved? I think not. But there are certainly certain artifacts out there from our history that we believe are worth struggling with. And we struggle with these artifacts and struggle with these buildings not because of an abstract curiosity. It's more about the ideas embodied by these buildings and their ideas that we want to be that we want to learn from. So the conversation about Neutra v. Schindler, Schindler you now see on the screen, is a wonderful dialogue about two different masters and how they communicated, how they molded the world around them. And when you look at this Schindler carport and you think about Schindler as a modernist and this form follows function tradition, well, in what sense could this carport be modern? It's incredibly sculptural. It's incredibly joyous. It's very evocative. And yet somehow we place this building and his work within this modern context. So how is Schindler a modernist? How is Neutra a modernist? How does the history of modern architecture within this community, which I think is one of the strongest histories in the world, how does that history relate to our buildings today? I think those are wonderful conversations. I hope to have some of those this evening, but we're certainly honored to have been able to participate with such important, wonderful historic structures. Which gets us into the conversation about prefab architecture. Every modernist struggled with this question. Can we turn the mechanism of industrialization toward design, toward houses, and somehow come out at the other end with a better product? And I will say every modernist at some level worked to fail within this arena. That is, we see within the history of modern architecture an incredibly wonderful, exuberant process of experimentation within the world of prefabrication, and a great series of business failures, social failures, failures to entice us as a community to get us drawn into this process of prefabrication. So we too are curious and interested in this process of whether it's possible to take a mechanized process and industrialized revolution and turn that into a house that you and I might want to live in. And especially as we think about the concepts of sustainability, how prefabrication might influence the conversation about sustainability. And I think this conversation is not just the untouched site out on the distant landscape, but I think it's a conversation also about our urban context. Can prefabrication in some way inform what we do in the arena of living within our cities? And so we have dabbled in this realm. We have thought about the relationship between prefabrication and the house and how it relates to that more global conversation about sustainability. I think I also wanted to take a moment to talk about heavy trash. And heavy trash, let me just read this because I want to make sure I get it right. Heavy trash is an anonymous organization of architects, artists, and builders who take art and ideas out of the galleries and into the streets. They create urban art installations to express their opinions regarding civic issues. So the challenge of heavy trash as a group of artists within the urban landscape is to think about social ideas and how we might express our response to social issues. The first issue of three that heavy trash will present right now is the issue of our urban parks. There is a park at the corner of Santa Monica Boulevard and Bundy. It is in the city of Los Angeles, and in its wisdom, the city has fenced this park off because, God forbid, people were actually using the park. Unfortunately, they were using the park for the wrong reasons. They were using the park to sleep in, to use as a public restroom, and God forbid, there's a Starbucks across the street, and they wanted coffee, and they were very disruptive to the businesses in the community. So the city fenced the park off. So the question is it possible for us to reopen the park? And so this is the great thing about having your own metal shop and your own wood shop, is you get to make stuff. So Heavy Trash built this stairway and reopened the park. And so it's a stair that was installed very quickly over this fence. And it's really interesting because we started to use the park and there was a 4th of July picnic in the park. Can you get arrested for trespassing in a park, in a public park that you and I are paying for? We never could answer that question because no one ever questioned the fact that we started to use the park. Originally, the city used caution tape to kind of wind around this and keep people from using the stairs. That was quickly removed. Eventually, they figured out a way to remove this thing. It was just sitting there. It just happened to be extremely heavy. Now, another issue is urban transportation. The issue is, why isn't there a metro line to the West Los Angeles, the west part of Los Angeles? So we said, well, there should be, and design matters. So we designed a line, heavy trash designed a line from downtown to Santa Monica. We identified the station points, and we heavy trash made a series of signs and put them up at the locations where those metro rail stops were going to happen. And at the bottom of the sign, there's a phone number. And it's not the sign that's so wonderful. The really wonderful part is, and the really frightening part is, all the messages that went into that recording. And it's really fascinating. It's a fascinating little study on our attitudes about public transportation. And there were many comments and total support. Members of the community who called the number and said, we're so excited to finally have an extension of the metro to Santa Monica. We also had many calls in. To say that they were concerned and angry would be an understatement. There were also the calls that we felt bad about, like the really panicked staff members from the various council offices that called in, and you can imagine their fear of having to explain this to their boss as to how they missed this in their district. There are these wonderful things, but the great thing is that urban art installations can influence the public dialogue. It was great that Councilman Parks went on an absolute public tirade against naming the now planned line to the west side, the Aqua Line, because it turned out the greatest supporter of this little urban intervention was, of course, the MTA, and they didn't prosecute anyone for absconding their logos and such. In fact, they were extremely wonderful that the conversation had been raised. Of course, Mr. Parts felt it was in bad taste to actually name the line after a bunch of hooligans who had nothing to do with transportation, of course. These are little observation platforms, little nice sculptural things designed to peer over the gates of walled communities. So these showed up at some of the most prestigious walled communities in our neighborhood to talk about this notion of how and why so much of our public space is in fact getting walled off and turned into very private space. And is this good for our city? Is this healthy for us as a community? And I just end that in saying that the reason I think design matters has nothing to do with our buildings, nothing to do with the conversation about architecture. The reason I think design matters is because you can use design to have a wonderful public dialogue about issues that are important to all of us. And if anything, if we could all use design for that purpose, is to challenge each other, then I think design is worthwhile. Thank you. I'm in a very feisty mood today.
Well, I'm stunned and amazed. I have wondered for years who that was. When did you decide to come out?
It's an anonymous group of artists and architects.
But you have nothing to do with it.
That I am just showing some slides of.
I'm really glad that you more or less admitted that you are part of that collective. And I'm really fascinated by that, because I think that when you use the issue that you can use design to have a dialogue, that is a way of having a dialogue. And I'm just wondering, like, how would you propose to do that, say, in a way where you didn't have to be anonymous? And how do you do that in your practice on a daily basis without being anonymous?
Sure. I think the issue of anonymity in the art community is a tough one. It's not necessarily healthy. I think anonymity breeds a lack of responsibility. And it's not to say that heavy trash is trying to be irresponsible. In fact, the opposite. It's just that anonymity takes away the personalization of the dialogue. It's not about us anymore. It's just about the issues. Where I think anonymity is dangerous and evil is when it comes to the internet. I don't think anyone should be able to express a personal opinion unless they're willing to put their name by it and therefore be challenged by others with differing opinions. But that's just my opinion.
I'm not going to reveal all my nom de guerre on the internet tonight, but that's okay. But I do think it raises an interesting issue, because if you're starting to talk about what in essence are a type of guerrilla public art practices versus architecture practices, I mean, architects have a different type of license than artists do. And I think that on one level, those projects are really incredible and they're amazing and they certainly caught my attention. But on another level, they have license to say whatever they want to say without having to have any type of responsibility at all in terms of the consequences. And if actually the majority of people disagree with that opinion, the artist still, to a certain degree, has the freedom to just tell the public that they're completely wrong. And that gets me, you know, you were talking about density to a certain degree, and you made what I would say is the standard professional architect's plea for density, that density can be good, you know, you can design density, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a lot of people in this town who vehemently disagree with you, who basically say that lack of density in a sort of peculiarly Los Angeles way is part of the DNA of our culture, and for us as architects to be somehow trying to go against that DNA as opposed to working with it just shows that we're completely out of touch and that we're more like public artists making irresponsible gestures that aren't really irresponsible, but then we are as architects who basically have to somehow come up with a solution. I mean, how do you react to that?
Well, I think that often it's really the will of what people want that will eventually come to pass. And for example, if you just look at, I just think even the concept of coffee shops that have really taken hold over the last two decades, I think they become gathering places. And that's why they're in fact successful. It isn't just for purely the consumption of coffee. It's because people want to meet. They want to bump into somebody. And if you take that on an expanded scale, then you get walking streets and neighborhoods. And I think that sure, LA was, you know, and still is a car city, but I think that the reinforcement of community is incredibly important. And I think it's kind of interesting that both Leo and I are actually talking about real issues. We're not talking about architecture as form making. We're really talking about what does architecture give back to each of us and to community. And you might want to add to that, Leo.
I think the issue of density is a difficult one. I think that the issues of sustainability will really save us all, in the sense that it gives us, I think, a common language to now put things like density into context. Density, for me, is the fact that we can make cities that are, in fact, more holistic, more sustainable. We can use less energy. We can waste less if we design that density well. There lies the challenge. If we mess it up as a community, density will be the death of our city as it gets more so. So I think it's the issue of sustainability that will circle back, I think, for both Stephen and I in all of this conversation. If we can couch the conversation about density in that context of sustainability and how it will make a healthier, greener city, I think that's very encouraging.
Even the point of restoring classic houses and where I also dealt with that issue on the addition to the Richard Neutra house is a form of sustainability in that it's not only saving an important piece of history, but it's also reinforcing a lineage of history.
But one of the things that I think is maybe one has to articulate in this is that the way you've talked about sustainability in essence becomes a performance standard. So, okay, we're going to design carbon neutral buildings, or we're going to basically insist that all buildings have, use 20% less energy than the baseline use in this particular year or whatever it is. And those types of things do have a tendency in a gross sense to cause big changes. But the catchphrase that you used is, well, showing people how to design it well. What does it mean in 2009 to design density well? How are we not designing density well? Or how should we design density well? Because that's the thing where design actually matters, because you can make a really ugly city that is energy efficient.
Well, again, design well, I don't necessarily mean pretty buildings. I mean that until we confront the fundamental problems of our transportation system and why we can't develop one here very well in Los Angeles, we won't design our cities very well. That underlying the problem with transportation are issues of class and race and really fundamental struggles. Why is it that we're building walled communities and becoming more and more obsessed with security? I think we need to deal with some of these issues. And as architects, we're totally not trained, and I have no idea how to do it, and we're not at all qualified to even enter this conversation.
Can't say any of that.
So I think until we kind of struggle and are honest with ourselves about our shortcomings, it doesn't matter whether the building is pink or blue or does this or that. I think the issue of design well or not well has something, it's far more important than the architecture.
Do you want to respond to that? I mean, I actually have a response to that, but I'm surprised to hear you say that, because I think what was brilliant about the Aqualine signs was that people woke up one morning and they saw something that was an analog to something that they were very, very familiar with, which was a transportation system that makes connections. I think that there were decisions that were made on the part of the people who did that about how you represent that, which were very, very particular. I mean, in part, they were referencing the old Vignelli, maps, subway maps of New York, the choice of the color. It conveyed to people at a very gut, emotional level that there was something about their city which both was missing, could be obtained, and if it was obtained, suggested a type of life. But the way that you got there was to, in essence, create this design or move it through a filter of design. If you had just gone to a public meeting and you had basically said, I want a subway, which lots of people do, I don't know that it has the same power to capture people's imagination. So I'm surprised to hear you sitting here saying that you have no idea or that you don't think it makes a difference whether it's pink or blue or something like that. I would think that as architects that at some level we would want to be able to something about pink and blue. And
I think we do want to say something about pink and blue. But it's that it's tough as an architect because we're not trained to really engage the social issues that we're talking about. And so I think as an architect, we have certain limitations. I think we can respond to really smart people and really caring people that give us the platform to address some of these density issues. But we, as a profession, we've been relegated to window dressing as a profession. There are whole other professions that have sprung up because we're doing a bad job. Construction managers, owners' representatives, general contractors, all these other professions, because the architect we've allowed ourselves to not take responsibility. And I know I'm speaking in circles here. I'm not sure what I'm exactly trying to say, other than I think the architect lacks certain training to really address the issue of density. I think we can respond to smart cues from people, but I don't think we're trained to actually solve the problem.
Well, I would put a different angle on it. I don't totally agree with that, Leo. I think that what I'm finding, and I think for me the Walter Cronkite building and the process of actually making it happen was quite an epiphany. And what it really meant to me for the first time was how collaborative the act of architecture really is and can be. And that, there are these titles of people who are managers and city managers and contractors, but everybody had a common goal, and we rolled up our sleeves and actually created something that is successful in how it engages the city, how the school has now become part of the downtown fabric of Phoenix. And I think that the architect is, in a sense, the conductor, has to have a vision and really be able to work with all these people. It's not about forcing a will, but understanding the issues and then trying to channel all the best energy and make it hopefully be part of the process of it happening.
Yeah, no, I agree, and it's what, John, you were talking about earlier that Michael Maltzen was alluding to, is that it's possible that our generation of architects, wherever that happens to be, was not trained to be the modern master, the dominant kind of ideologue that imposes their will upon the landscape, but rather the architect as the collaborator, as the community organizer, as the one who can somehow coalesce differing opinions into some kind of physical response, and that we see that, and I do agree with this, that as a healthier response, and that therefore the modern kind of force out there is not the healthy one when it comes to addressing
right.
issues of density.
And having said that, however, I also believe that you can't design by committee. You can't have a total democracy to create good architecture.
Well,
I don't believe that happens that way.
Well, but this is the tension, though, because, see, on one level, you started off saying, well, you know, architects can't do that. Then we sit here and say, but you know what? In reality, we're actually a kind of medium by which people can figure out how to make better decisions. But then, if we're a medium and we don't actually control the medium, but we are the medium itself, it means that it's possible that we'll go through this whole exercise, we'll present things to people, and they might make a choice that we as individuals feel very uncomfortable with. Like an example that I would give would be, let's talk about preservation for a second. I think a lot of architects in general are somewhat suspect of the historic preservation enterprise as it has grown. And not because we're not in favor of saving buildings, and even maybe buildings that aren't so fantastic, but because I think that we're increasingly seeing that preservation has become about saving everything.
Right.
And if you even look at the history of, say, how the Secretary of the Interior standards are interpreted, they've become interpreted more and more conservatively over time. And so that's a situation, at least, where we bring tremendous value and intelligence to these conversations, and yet the public as a whole in some ways may not be as comfortable with, let's just say, contemporary juxtaposition as architects themselves are.
Sure. I mean, there's so many issues wrapped up in that. I think that the language and conversation about preservation, once again, also needs to shift toward sustainability, because if the conversation is just about save everything, we can't and we shouldn't. However, the greatest environmental act we can do is in fact to save everything. The figures are staggering in terms of the amount of embodied energy that is in each building. And if we simply save 10% of the current building stock that is right now slated to be demolished in the next 10 years, we can
power the city of New York for something like 10 years. That's how much energy has been committed to our existing buildings. So there is an argument to save everything from the sustainability perspective. From the preservation perspective, is everything important to us culturally? Does everything represent an important historical moment in our cultural growth? No, of course not. So I think we have to make the distinction between preservation for the sake of cultural preservation and understanding and preservation for the sake of sustainability. Either way, it's really an argument about saving our existing buildings.
Well, I want to ask one more question before I open it up to both of you, because you raised what happens to be my favorite subject in design, which is the whole sort of intersection of design and democracy. And I think de Tocqueville said at one point that you could do a lot of great things in a democracy, but you couldn't really get any good buildings out of it. I'm paraphrasing him, but it is in there in Democracy in America somewhere. And I'm just wondering, you raised this issue of like, well, you know, how do both of you as architects deal with this idea that at some level culture is generated popularly? It's not generated by expert architects or experts, culture workers or whatever you want to call it. It's generated popularly. How do you put yourself in terms of what matters to you about design into the context of this larger conversation, which may or may not be sympathetic to what you personally stand for and what you personally believe in?
Well, one of the phrases I like using is that architecture is one of the performing arts. And I say that because we have to go before so many public boards and community meetings that really performance is part of it. And having the passion to convince a diverse group that, you know, this project really should be there. It really deserves to be there. I think, however, that there are so many voices, and often city council members will go with the voice of the largest number of voters in
you
their
district.
You don't
mean our city council.
No,
right?
Not our.
Right.
City councils in
abstract
general.
Abstract councils out there.
Wherever they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a problem, because they inherently are not envisioning a future. They're trying to probably stabilize the past and in a sense freeze it. And I think we've all seen Not in My Backyard syndrome, where, you know, once somebody gets into that neighborhood, wherever that may be, they try to freeze it in time. Oh, it's just perfect the way it is, and not have change continue. And density is part of that conversation. And I think that I think we're a growing city. We're a densifying city. We should be doing that. And I think things take time to change. But it's a slow process.
Where do you put yourself in that continuum of dealing with these democratic forces? And
well, I think, again, these are hard things to struggle with. I would be lying to say that I enjoy standing up in front of a board and have them tell me what I should do as an architect. That where I think the social dictate goes awry is when the community as a whole wants to dictate what it looks like. That's different than legislating what it should do, how it operates, how tall it should be, how wide it should be, all of those things. And I think where I draw the line is when that board, when that design review group, when that whatever tells me, and therefore my client, you as an owner of that building, that you can't paint it blue. I think they should be able to tell you that it can only be 30 feet tall, or whatever it is they're telling you in terms of its character, size, and such. But its aesthetic response, I think that's not the realm of community. I think democracy should get out of dictating what things look like and should become more focused and more intelligent about dictating how things operate and how things should be within our city. And so that's it. I just think you should give the community as a whole should give the realm of the aesthetic back to the homeowner and the building owner, and be more aggressive about the other aspects of it. So I guess I'm in that middle ground. It's choosing the battles wisely, and letting people have more freedom in how they express and respond to those battles, which means, unfortunately, we have to accept really bad work along with the really good work. If you're going to, as a community, accept the really good, that means you're also not legislating out the really bad. So you have a much broader range of architectural response. Because the safe way is to be in Santa Barbara or some of those communities where they say it has to be X.
It has to be white.
Right. That it, exactly.
That wasn't the way it was meant to come out, but it came out that way.
Exactly. I think that you narrow the potential for good, certainly, but also for bad.
Well, it's a fascinating and complicated subject, but I think rather than belabor it, we should probably ask our wonderful audience, where there are all sorts of interesting people out here, if they have any questions. And it's hard to see, but they're bringing up the lights. Good. There's a microphone, and are there any hands? This woman right here, down here, has her hand up. And you get to go first, yes. But you have to wait for the microphone. There you go.
Okay, here we go. I'd be very interested in getting your take and your opinion of the why of the fascination that, as a culture, we have in Southern California for this faux Mediterranean. In the 50s and the 40s, we were a culture of like all sorts of really interesting architecture. Why does everybody, not everybody, but such a huge number of people love, you know, arches and tile roofs?
So did everybody hear that? Why do so many people love arches and tile roofs? And it's kind of what we're talking about.
I don't know the answer, but it seems better than Cape Cod to me.
Have any thoughts on that?
None whatsoever. It's interesting. Why do we like certain responses, architectural responses, and why do we see them over and over again? I think there are a lot of reasons. Certainly economics have to come into this conversation. There's certain architectural responses that are less expensive to execute than others. So of course you're going to see punched windows as a norm, little windows and big walls as a norm in earthquake country than big windows, because to get a big window in earthquake country is much more complicated and expensive. And so you're going to see models where economics play a bigger role in the development of that building move towards small punched windows because of that.
But you have to admit, doing a really good Mediterranean building will cost you a lot of money.
Ultimately, it all costs a lot of money. Right. But it costs a lot less of more to do a small window than...
More, maybe less in that case. Maybe we should go, the gentleman in the back there. We'll sort of try to spread this around.
Just one of the great things about Allowed is that there's a lot of different sciences and studies that can come into it. Jared Diamond talks about a closed community with walls. And also Peter Weibrow talked about the Americans not really understanding community. And I'll preface this by saying, in about 2002, 95% of Los Angeles residents were renters. I'm a renter. I consider myself an end user. And where we're going, I'm trying to understand. What I've seen tonight is more of an elitist position with people who have money and can design and dictate what I'm going to be using 20 years down the line as it's been degraded. And recently, our city council, I don't believe... uses voters, I think they follow the money trail. And they have just okayed variances in Hollywood instead of 600 square feet to move it down to 300 square feet in a 10,000 dense, 300 square feet per apartment.
400.
Is it 400?
Yeah.
Okay, so a third has been knocked off of expectations. And the density is going to be Westwood, it's going to be Hollywood, and it's going to be downtown. And maybe along the Wilshire corridor.
So what is your question is,
as an end user, what do I get to expect these very learned gentlemen who are setting design standards up to expect that I can be able to use in 20 years?
We are not doing SROs and projects like that, but there are some very talented architects in Los Angeles that are doing really exciting projects, people like Pew Scarpa and Koenig Eisenberg. And I mean, I'm dealing often with public buildings, and I'm very concerned about the public arena. So, I mean, architects don't always deal with every issue. What does it look like in 20 years? I think that there will be taller, denser communities. That's what I
see. But don't you think, Stephen, I mean, to answer the gentleman's question more directly, it seems to me that there are certain great traditions which exist in Southern California domestic architecture, many of which are on display in the Neutra show, indoor-outdoor relationships, which you're very interested in, certain interesting aspects of, say, prefabrication, which you've struggled with. And it strikes me that there is no inherent contradiction between working within this climate and making a dense building. The question is to have a much richer dialogue about how to do that so that some of the things that people value and some of the things that make this particular city incredibly unique in terms of its architectural tradition gets translated into that architecture. And I think that the thing that you're specifically referring to is just a number. And this is why I was sort of pressing Leo on this question. In the end, design matters because you can establish all these performance standards, but they don't necessarily tell you whether it's a good building for this particular place. It still matters that the thing get designed in some way and that we learn from those design experiences and then build those back into the code. So I would hope that you would get really active and go to all those meetings in Hollywood and express your opinion, because it does make a difference.
But I think too, I mean, you raised the issue of the elite and the criticism of the elite as setting social norm. First of all, especially like in politics, where it's like the best kind of mud to sling at someone is you're an elite. And I always wonder, when did that become bad to be a professional politician, to really know your task and your trade and to grow up and be trained to, in fact, lead us as a community, as a politician? It's strange that if you're, in fact, a professional expert at that community dialogue, that somehow that's negative. But I think in the modern context of all of this, there was always this underpinning of the modern language and the modern conversation about housing with social responsibility, how to house the masses, how to provide good design for the general population, or as many people as possible. And in fact, the case study program was in fact that, and Julius Shulman, and I've been thinking about him a lot lately, he used to always rail against that program, that it was a dismal failure as a program because it didn't make modern housing available to the masses. Prefabrication certainly never made great houses available, however you define great, but really good, solid, well-designed, lasting houses available to the masses. Total failure as a social program. It's not to say that the challenge and the question is a bad one, and I hope we haven't given up on the challenge of designing well for more people, because so many of us have failed. I just think it's a hard problem, but we shouldn't give up the quest, and you shouldn't criticize those on that quest as elites, because it's in fact the elites that will help us find really good answers to really hard problems.
So I'm going to get around back this direction, but we're going to just swing around. So this woman over here.
You've talked about the sort of the decision-making process for design, whether it be preservation or sustainability or density or community standards. It sounds like the process right now, at least it's hard for me to understand exactly who's making the decisions now, but if you feel that democracy is not the best way to do it, then that to me implies somebody has to be in charge and have more power than somebody else. So could either, all three of you, tell me what you would like to see in terms of who should make the decisions and define the specifications for any of those issues?
It's such a broad question.
Good one.
It's... It's a, I mean, it is a dance. I know whatever I say will not answer your question. I just want to say that first. But there, I think it's a dialogue. I think that the architect plays a key role, and I think the architect has to have a vision. But the architect will also be definitely controlled by the economic and political will that always, and there is no building if there isn't an executive director or executive producer, I should say, of that movie, meaning the person who's going to build that building. I mean, that's very important. The architect has to have the vision, hopefully embrace the myriad of players and people and voices, and hopefully not just have it watered down as, you know, if you mix every color together, you get the color of mud, and, you know, that's not the answer.
If you're not willing to say, who do you think should have more power than somebody else?
Well, Steven's not, but maybe Leo is.
Okay, try.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I would vote for John.
And I actually have, you know, it's funny because I'm an architect in the end, but I'm a very different architect than these two. And the truth of the matter is that I have absolutely no problem with the democratic process. And in part, it's because I agree completely with what Steven said. The architect's role in that is as a performance artist. You're going to win, you're going to lose. If communities like Santa Barbara want to be Mediterranean, you know what? They're just not going to hire me. And I don't think I'm going to lose a lot of sleep over that. And the same thing is true in Santa Fe. I think where it gets a little bit scarier is in a city like Los Angeles, where it is incredibly diverse and it's incredibly complicated. And when you see certain communities start to sort of go the Santa Fe route or the Santa Barbara route, as much as I like those cities, I think as architects we have to be willing to stand up and make our point of view heard and be a lot smarter in terms of being understanding how to engage in these dialogues. But in the end, I cannot imagine that any of us are going to stand up on this stage and basically say, you know what, if the Fuhrer came back, we'd all be better off. I mean, it just isn't going to work like that. And Albert Speer actually was a great architect in many, many ways, but I'm not willing to, you know, I'm really not willing to live in a culture that wants to have that type of executive authority. It's not, we don't believe in that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would dictate it, but I realized somebody's got to have the final say, and I'm curious who you think that should be.
Well, I think we live in a society in which the genius of our society is that the people do have the final say. And it's an ugly, sometimes very messy and complex and sometimes beautiful process.
And I think in many ways the process actually works fairly well. As messed up as the outcome often is, there is really an opportunity for all of us to have a voice if you have the energy and the desire to participate in that voice. So that's all positive. My comments earlier were not that the democratic process is evil from a design perspective. I think it's quite healthy, especially in an architectural context. It's just there's certain parts of that arena that the dialogue should just stay away from, whether it's pink or blue, I don't think should enter the conversation. I think there are more important pieces of that conversation that should remain democratic. And I don't think you're going to find many architectural practitioners arguing for the dictator. We're all convinced, I think, at this point, that the community, the architect as community organizer, okay, maybe there's a few exceptions, but the architect as community organizer is a positive, healthy thing. So I don't think that the system is itself inherently a problem.
So do we want to push on to the next question?
I just want to say one thing. The great and late Louis Kahn said that the building will discover what it wants to be.
Okay, well, I want to be really even about this because I said I'd eventually come down to here. So was there anybody on that side of the room that I had not been able to see? Okay, but how about in that back section, the woman that you're about to run into right there? Yeah.
I'm curious to know what your thoughts and feelings are on the U.S. Green Building Council, the LEED program, the LEED certification program for professionals. in establishing and setting design goals relevant to things like sustainability, density, et cetera. Is this something that the architectural community embraces, or is it useful? What sort of role is it playing?
It's completely embraced.
Does everybody know what the kind person is referring to? Yeah. Okay, great.
It's very important. It's completely embraced by the architectural community, and I think that within 5 years it won't even be mentioned. It'll be part and parcel to the way everybody thinks.
I think that finally we have a national standard, actually a worldwide standard now, to talk about variations between different buildings. The problem before LEED, and we started doing sustainable design back in the early 1990s, and the problem at the time was everyone was saying, well, we had a green building, or we're responding environmentally, but no one knew what that meant. There was no way to judge how well you were doing. So LEED has finally provided that bench line, so that's incredibly healthy. I think the caution to it all that designers, I hope, will embrace is that we have to be careful when there's one baseline, because we can think that meeting the needs of the baseline is doing enough. So if we get to certification, we've done enough, and we can pat ourselves on the back and move on. The definition of sustainability as a performance spec misses the boat. It's not about performance of our building. To me, sustainability is the fact that we've all been completely disconnected from the environment around us. We've forgotten what it is to be human out there in the natural world. And we all long for that connection. Sustainability is about reconnecting to the rhythms and the cycles in our planet. LEED and many of the other performance standards are a great way to measure that, but that's the goal. It's not getting one building to LEED Platinum or 100 buildings to LEED Platinum. It's feeling once again culturally that we're connected to the planet that we inhabit. And that's a really hard thing when culturally we've gone completely the other direction.
Yeah, it is interesting that one of the big criticisms of LEED has been that to a certain degree it's relied too heavily on technological solutions as opposed to the type of vernacular solutions, say, that Stephen was mentioning. We were looking at the new version of it, which is basically effective as of this fall, and it's interesting they now have the regional design points or whatever you want to call it, and they're left very, very amorphous in terms of how you achieve those. But it is an interesting thing, and coupled with the little piece of stuff that about carbon neutral buildings, zero, all buildings being carbon neutral, including rehabilitation in the United States by 2050, that was buried in the climate bill that was recently passed by Congress. There are going to be huge changes in buildings. So it's, and the architecture profession's endorsed it. So we have one more question. I said I'd come down here somewhere. This woman right here, who has had her hand up diligently and faithfully for almost the entire time.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate what you had to say. And it is very clear in both of your presentations when you mentioned that architecture is more than the building, and I think a lot of people think of architects as architecture, just building the building. What role can the architectural community play in being much more vocal about how we move forward, not just kind of being there at the end product and going to city councils or public boards or whoever, but really getting in front of the discussion? Because you understand, you know, Stephen, you talked about community and density and culture and how all those things impact. And I guess I'd like to see you out in front of the urban planning folks to be a part of that voice. So what role can the architectural community play to be much more forceful for us?
Well, John's doing a good job. He's the president of the AIA.
John's our hero.
But
I'll let them answer it.
Hi, Tyree. Nice to see you. It's a great point, and I think by our nature we do go out there and communicate and try to listen to the heartthrob of the city. Not everyone is going to be the president of the AIA or even on the planning commission. So I think that, at least for my part, I mean, I'm an architectural soldier doing his job. I try to do the best I can with the time and energy and that I and a staff of 30 people have, and And we try to treat every building with great enthusiasm and try to deal with the issues that I spoke about.
Yeah, and I think the architectural profession is totally the same as every other profession in the sense that we're all just individuals trying to do the best we can, living our lives. We all have to make our own personal choices as to how we participate, what we feel personally we can and can't achieve. And luckily, there are enough of us, and we're a divergent enough population, getting more divergent all the time, which is healthy. And that there's and the more diversity we can create within our ranks, the healthier we will be, because some of us will choose urban planning routes, being on the CRA, some of us will choose just to decorate buildings, whatever it happens to be. But I think the profession is a pretty diverse, rich mix of quirky individuals. And I think that's true of every profession. So we can only do the same as whatever you're doing, whatever profession you're in, is to choose our path and do it with as much passion as we can muster.
Well, I would just say that, you know, I spend most of my day just trying to, like, not go out of business right now, but...
oh, yeah, that. You had to bring that up.
But notwithstanding that, the second thing I was going to say is that Stephen Ehrlich is also on the board of the AIA, and he whispers in my ear, and everything he tells me to do, I do. And right. But in all seriousness, I think that in general, architects as a profession have treated their organizational activities more as a club, perhaps an elite club, than they have as a type of organizing force within the culture. And I think one of the interesting things in Los Angeles over the last 10 or 15 years is that there are increasing number of architects who basically really feel that we owe it to ourselves and our own self-interest as architects, but also to the city that we live in, the culture that we live in, to become more organized in terms of how we respond to the types of issues that are being raised all around us, whether it's at the neighborhood council level, whether it's within the city government, or even at the state and federal levels. And so that type of activism is something that I've at least been very interested in and have tried to ramp up. I mean, Will Wright, who somebody mentioned, he not only organized this, but, you know, we have a director of legislative affairs in Los Angeles, which is, there are only two chapters, AIA chapters in the United States that have that. Then the state ones do and the national ones do. So we've done that here in Los Angeles. So I think at the core of this, though, is really what this whole conversation was about, which is to find ways to articulate how design matters to people. And Stephen mentioned that design matters because when design is really done well, it reinforces community, that density done well allows people to come together in new and exciting ways that are reflective of the diversity of the society we live in. Both Leo and Stephen talked a lot about sustainability. You know, architects are not the only people who are interested in sustainability, but when you look at things like the 2030 initiative for carbon neutrality, and you realize that if that's fully implemented by 2050, we will not have to build 100 nuclear power plants. In fact, we will not have to build any power plants in this country. You know, buildings consume 70% of the energy in the United States. So that's an incredibly important thing. And then, you know, your little outline, which also mentioned culture, you know, I think it was a beautiful metaphor to describe us as a type of performance art. You know, performance art to a certain degree is a way that gets people talking, and architecture can get people talking, and architecture can serve as a means by which, and design can serve as a means by which people come together to help decide their future, and a picture is worth 1,000 words, and a design is worth 10,000 words, at least in architectural design. So hopefully that not only answers your question, but summarizes some of the wonderful points that both Stephen and Leo made tonight. I, too, want to encourage all of you as you're leaving this evening to put your design dollars into the library cup so that they can continue to have wonderful conversations like this with, you know, wonderful people like Leo and Steve, who really are, through their actions more than anything else, telling us how to live a much better and wonderful future. So thank you very much.
Allowed Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Allowed theme composed by Larry Karish.